We'll see about that. You know, it takes so long to transition from being dad to, you know, when your kids are in their 30s and they've got their own families. And she even had to scold me one time saying, "Dad, Paul, I done got married." You know, it's kind of like, leave me alone. Ah, they do a great job. I love my kids. Hey, everybody knows what a finale is, right? I mean, I don't have to try to explain that too much. I know we've got musicians here, and they know that a finale in a symphony is, you know, the final section of the symphony. It's also, it translates into anything. The closing number of a stage performance is called a finale. It carries over into movies and TV. You have a TV series, and they got the season finale. And that's, you know, when everything is, you know, you've got this great dramatic buildup, or maybe sometimes it, you know, takes you to a cliffhanger or whatever, but it's always an intensification of the drama, an intensification of the action that's been happening so far. We're going to consider the idea of finales today as we carry on in our exploration of the Gospel of Mark. If you have a Bible with you or a Bible app, and if you'd like to follow along, find your way to Mark 13, please. If we know nothing else about God, we know that he is an excellent storyteller. He's a story maker. And Mark's gospel accentuates that reality in the way that it's written. It's written in such a way that it could easily have been a dramatic presentation. There's a scholarly argument for that case, that this was more of a performance than it was just something to be written or parsed out as a study manual or something like that. We're in a section, it's really all of chapter 13, which gets more dramatic still as it provides a cryptic foreshadowing of a finale that's coming in God's story of creation and redemption. But as we said when we started this last week, we've got to be careful because we've got to figure out what finale we're talking about in this. As we began chapter 13 last week, we read Jesus' forecast of the end of the temple age and how that came to pass in 70 AD, something that he was forecasting as a future event, which for us is a past event. But we also read his cautions about responding well to the troubles that are inherent in this earth, that continue on cyclically in this world as we wait for Jesus to return. And today that theme is going to continue on, and we'll have to puzzle through some of the ways in which his predictions seem to expand beyond just the end of the temple age into something farther reaching, maybe even getting a glimpse of the end of history as well. It's not cut and dry. It is not something we can go in and just say, well, bloop, 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 this is this and that and that. And this, I believe, should never be the territory of dogmatism. This is not a place we should wander into, set up our little homestead, and not be moved from our position because people all through history have been embarrassed by doing things like that. I don't think it's wise, but we're going to look at various views as to how we should interpret this chapter. And again, we're going to draw some assurances that affect how it is that we live right now in light of what Jesus is saying about either a future for him or a future for us. And we know ultimately it does include a future for us. So if you're there in Mark 13, we're going to pick up where we left off last week, starting with verse 14. Jesus is still talking, and he says, "The day is coming when you'll see the sacrilegious object that causes desecration standing where it should not be. Reader, pay attention. Then those in Judea must flee to the hills. A person out on the deck of his roof must not go down into the house to pack." I guess just jump off the side. Or a person out in the field must not return even to get a coat. How terrible it will be for pregnant women and for nursing mothers in those days. And pray that your flight will not be in winter. For there will be greater anguish in those days than at any time since God created the world. And it will never be so great again. In fact, unless the Lord shortened that time of calamity, not a single person will survive. But for the sake of his chosen ones, he has shortened those days. Then, and if anyone tells you, look, here's the Messiah, or there he is, don't believe it. From false messiahs and false prophets will rise up and perform signs and wonders so as to deceive, if possible, even God's chosen ones. Watch out. I've warned you about this ahead of time. Okay, So we'll stop here for a minute. There's a lot here to examine and puzzle through. Jesus begins this whole section by warning about a sacrilegious, desecrating object set up in some forbidden place. A lot of translations call this the abomination of desolation, which, again, means nothing. I mean, for us, as, you know, okay, even this is a little bit tricky, but give it to the NLT for trying to, you know, put it in language we can quickly access. A sacrilegious desecrating object, meaning some sort of object or idol or something set up in a forbidden place, obviously referencing the temple, and we'll kind of explore that and see why that is. And then Mark inserts an instruction, reader, pay attention. In other words, this is not going to be easily understood on the surface. This is going to be something that's going to require some serious contemplation and thinking about the situation. So here we're faced with this difficult task of allowing the ancient text to speak to a modern audience without doing damage to that ancient text or original intent, and yet still be able to derive meaning from it. Not an easy task, but it's one that has occupied the church for about 2,000 years. Jesus provides a clear indicator for his listeners, something that they're to be anticipating, something which is going to trigger the catastrophes that his followers are going to face, to the point where he's saying you need to run for the hills, and even running for the hills is going to be a hazardous journey. It's going to be a terrible situation. And so our task is to try to locate what it is he's talking about in this. And to do that, we got to follow all the hyperlinks that are in this text. Remember, we've said before, Tim Mackey made the point that the whole New Testament is filled with either direct references or repeated patterns from the Hebrew Bible, from the Old Testament. And we need to treat those like hyperlinks that we can click on and go back and get the larger picture, to get a context by which we can kind of understand what's being said in the present text. So our first hyperlink is to the book of Daniel. In Daniel 9, an angel gives the prophet a glimpse of Israel's future. The book of Daniel is written from the perspective of being in Babylonian exile, when Israel was taken away into Babylon for 70 years. And so Daniel gets a vision from an angel where he sees Israel's been restored and the temple's been rebuilt and an anointed leader rises up, but this anointed leader, you know, suffers calamity and another pagan ruler arises to oppress Israel. Here's what Jesus is quoting. It could get convoluted if I'm not careful here. Daniel 9, 26. This is all apocalyptic language. In other words, it's going to be using a lot of figurative speech and exaggeration to try to make a point that's coming across here. So in Daniel 9, the anointed one will be killed. Obviously speaking of Messiah, or a type of Messiah, appearing to have accomplished nothing. And a ruler will arise whose armies will destroy the city and the temple. The end will come with a flood and a war, and its miseries are decreed from that time to the very end. The ruler will make a treaty with the people for a period of one set of seven, but after half of this time, he'll put an end to the sacrifices and offerings. And as a climax to all of his terrible deeds, he'll set up a sacrilegious object that causes desecration. There's that line in there, until the fate decreed for his defiler is finally poured out on him. So that doesn't need any explanation. You can figure that out. As I said, a lot of cryptic language used in apocalyptic literatures, which is what Daniel is. And so he's Daniel, the prophet there, was forecasting something that was coming. Interestingly enough, almost 200 years before Jesus, this same sort of scenario that Daniel is describing here played out in Israel's history. Jerusalem had been rebuilt. They had a new temple in place, but a Seleucid king named Antiochus Epiphanes annexed Jerusalem, and he set up a shrine. So back in 175 BC, and he, in annexing Israel and trying to Hellenize Israel, in other words, make it more Gentile in its mindset, he set up a shrine to Zeus right in the temple, and they began sacrificing pigs on the altar there outside. And that became the tipping point that actually started the Maccabean revolt back in 167 BC. So like I said, almost 200 years before Jesus came, something that Daniel predicted there seemed to really actually happen. In fact, the people of Jesus' day, which we know from rabbinical writings that are passed down to us from that time, people of Jesus' day assumed that that prophecy had already been fulfilled about the object of desecration. But Jesus, when he's speaking of it, speaks about it as though it's a future event, something that they're waiting to have happen, even though it already seemed to have happened in their history. And sure enough, we have the story unfolding. Jesus, the anointed one, is killed. 40 years later, Titus, a Roman general, soon to be the emperor of Rome, laid siege to Jerusalem, and he destroyed it along with the temple. And in destroying it, he brought in the Roman standards into the temple court. The Roman standards were long held to be desecrating objects by the Jewish people. They wouldn't allow them anywhere near the temple or inside the temple courts. When it was destroyed, the standards were set up in the temple. And so it appears to have been fulfilled again in history. It was a horrible event. If you read Josephus' account of it, it is so frightening. It must have felt like the end of the world to those who were involved in that. Everything that they'd known had been destroyed and taken down. And that's where Jesus quotes Daniel 12:1. It'll be a time of anguish greater than any since the world started. And many scholars, we'd probably almost say the majority of scholars, understand that as apocalyptic hyperbole. It's an exaggeration to make a point that this is a terrible event that will be remembered all through history, which the fall of Jerusalem surely was, a terrible event that nobody's forgotten. Now, there's different schools of thought as to Jesus' words here. Some believe that everything that he said here was entirely fulfilled in 70 AD, and they see that as the end of that section and the beginning of something new. Some believe that it wasn't referencing 70 AD at all, but that it's all talking about some future event for us somewhere out there that is still yet to happen after the temple gets rebuilt in Jerusalem and some other figure arises. Some believe that this may be partially fulfilled in the past and may have some fulfillment again in a cyclical way in the future. I fall into that last camp. But even there, I sit very loosely on that branch. When my dad used to, we'd talk about, you know, issues of prophetic significance out of the scriptures, and my dad gave me advice that I've held onto this whole time. He said, whatever branch you sit on, sit loosely, so that if it breaks, you can jump to the next one as quick as you can. And I think that's wise counsel. What I think our takeaway from this, you know, if we're looking at this, and it could be problematic. We look at this, and he's using language that could incite a level of concern or fear even. We want to look at the assurances that he gives us in this as well. And one of the things that I think we can be assured of is that we can be assured that troubles are going to continue and increase until the end of history. In other words, we don't want to let these things throw us when they're happening all around us in the world and on the news. One of the messages that I believe the book of Revelation is trying to communicate is that there is this cyclical pattern to this and through history, that the powers of this world are continually resisting and fighting against the inbreaking of God's kingdom to set up his rule. And I consider it quite possible that this is a forecast by Jesus that will have some future fulfillment in it in some way, but in some capacity. But I definitely believe it was fulfilled in the past. It definitely was fulfilled back then. I'm just not someone who sees a lot of benefit in trying to nail down exactly, you know, what this or that detail may mean in our modern world. I think probably because I've grown up with people doing that. I've grown up in association with the church, not always in church, but certainly around it. My dad as a preacher and our family, coming from the worldview that we had, I've heard these things a lot through my lifetime, a lot. I think I've told you before, it's 50-something predictions of when Jesus was going to return. So after a while, it starts to lose its impact. And I just don't see a lot of good fruit over the years that comes from trying to obsess about the details about when these things are going to happen. Our job description, what we have to remember, and this is part of the assurance of this, our job description does not change no matter when these events take place, no matter what is happening or when it happens. It's not my job and it's not your job to figure out all the details. We've been called to live out our faith in daily life so that we can make a difference in this world right where we live, so that we can love God by loving people. And that never changes. There's never a point in time in any of these stories where he says, you know, and then when this happens, you can quit doing all of that and, you know, just get in a bunker somewhere or whatever. The driving emphasis of the Gospels as well as the whole New Testament is about living out our faith and our love for God day by day, right in the world wherever we've been set. And according to how I understand Scripture, the world is a gnarly place and it's trending towards worse things. And we see that happen over and over again. But we can model a better world by living out the values of the kingdom of God right where we live in the here and now. We can live as though that future good is already present. In fact, that's what we're called to. When Jesus calls us to even pray, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, he's not talking about out there. He's talking about in here, that his will is done on earth, on this earth, like it's done in heaven, that we live as though his kingdom is already here and already active, which it is through us. But we don't want to be thrown by all the observations that we can make of how the world trends towards getting worse. We can be assured, and it may seem like a strange assurance, but we can be assured that it will get worse. It'll get bad before God redeems all things. But our job description never changes through it all. So don't be thrown. Acknowledge it. Recognize it. This is the way it's going. But my job is not to obsess about that. My job is to reflect a better world that's coming. Okay, well, let's keep reading here. Verse 24. It says, after the anguish of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will give no light. The stars will fall from the skies and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. Then everyone will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds with great power and glory. And he'll send his angels to gather his chosen ones from all over the world, from the farthest ends of the earth and heaven. Now learn a lesson from the fig tree. When its branches bud and its leaves begin to sprout, you know that summer's near. In the same way, when you see all these things taking place, you can know that his return is very near, right at the door. I tell you the truth, this generation will not pass from the scene before all of these things take place. Heaven and earth will disappear, but my words will never disappear. Okay, we'll stop here too. This is another section that's just filled with hyperlinks all the way through it. Jesus begins by quoting a mashup. It's really interesting to me how New Testament writers didn't play by any of the rules that we established after the Enlightenment. But anyway, so he kind of, you know, he'll pull from this place and that place and put it together as one. But it's a mashup of Isaiah 13 and Isaiah 34, where the prophet is forecasting the invading army of Babylon, which was going to come in and destroy Jerusalem. You know, this is like 400 years prior to that or so, about 300 years prior to that. And so the invading army of Babylon was going to come in and do all this damage. And the prophet says that when that happens, the heavens will be black and the stars will give no light. And then later he prophesies against the nations of the world and he forecasts the destruction of the ancient kingdom of Edom. And he describes its ruin by saying that the heavens would melt and roll away like a scroll and the stars would fall from the skies. Now, the thing we have to pay attention to is those hyperlinks that he's giving us there are going back to prophecies that took place. They actually happened. The armies of Babylon did come in and destroy Jerusalem. Edom did fall. But none of these other things literally happened in those moments when those kingdoms fell. It wasn't, you know, the stars weren't falling, the sky wasn't literally black. But again, it's language used to describe the ferocious ways in which these things were going to end for them. It's an intentional hyperbole in order to drive home the point of how disastrous this is going to be. So this hyperlink is telling us that what Jesus is talking about is in the same vein as that, that the events are going to feel cosmic in their scope because it ends up being the end of the world for these people as they've known it in their situation like that. And then Jesus hyperlinks to Daniel 7, where the prophet saw the Messiah, you know, called the Son of Man, ascending on a cloud to his place at the Father's right hand. And from there, He gathers all that are his and he sets the world right. I believe that that's speaking of both the church age and Christ's return to this world, to gather all that belong to him. And in pointing to nature, he's telling them that when you see the fig tree blossom, you know that summer's coming and that fall is going to be right behind it. And in the same way, we can observe how the world keeps cycling through each generation. And we know that this is headed towards God's good ending. That all of these things that are happening around us are leading us towards this moment when Christ does return. It's one of the things we talked about in communion this morning, just reinforcing our confidence and faith that Christ will return and set this right. Now, when Jesus says that this generation isn't going to pass away until all of this happens, that's actually a pretty solid case for the focus of this prediction being the destruction of Jerusalem and the end of the temple dispensation in 70 AD. But it could also be referring to the final act, that when all of these things begin happening, he could be saying that when it happens, it'll escalate so quickly that in less than a generation's time span, these things will be fulfilled. So it's not like when you see things escalating to a worse point or something else that's happening, maybe there will be another temple some point down the line. Maybe there will be another object brought into it that brings desolation. And he's saying, though, in that you know, this culmination of things is going to happen in less than a generation's time. It did in the end of the temple age. It could at the end of history. I honestly don't know. And it's one of those things I'm comfortable enough not knowing about. I'm comfortable enough to put this in God's hands and trust that the overarching details, that this is a bad and broken world and that Jesus is going to return and set it right, those are details enough for me to find confidence in this. Because what captures my attention and what I pin my hope to is verse 31, where Jesus said, "Heaven and earth can pass away." In other words, all that we know of in this created life is transient. Everything that we know of in this world right now is subject to the second law of thermodynamics. Everything is winding down and breaking down and getting worse. But this promise he gives us is that his words will remain forever. In other words, this promise that he will return and set everything right will not fade away. No matter what else around us may be fading, no matter what else gets shaken, this is not gonna fade away. And this is what I choose to focus on in the midst of a troubled and fading world, that we can be assured that Jesus is going to return and set everything right. His word is that it will come to pass. Things happen in this world and calamities happen and then they calm down. You know, we see that happen all the time on a regular basis. Nations rise up and nations fall. And it's been happening since Jesus spoke these predictions. But his predictions will come to pass in a way that's consistent with the rest of the story. The fact that I don't know what it will look like or exactly how it will work out, that's irrelevant to me. It's just another reason not to get all wigged out when we hear news events of things happening, disturbing global events or whatever, because no matter what happens, Jesus' words will come to pass. They did in 70 AD. I believe he was predicting the end of the temple there. It may have included more, but he definitely was predicting the end of the temple, and that happened. And that's a thing I don't think we spend enough time talking about as the church. We kind of blow past that like as if it's no big deal. That's huge. The events of 70 AD changed the world as we know it. It's an incredible thing that happened there. Jesus told us way beforehand that it was going to be happening. And so it's all going to come to pass just like he said, even if we don't understand what he said. He's going to return. He's going to set everything right. And that's the stuff we need to know and hold on to and believe in. We can be assured of that. And in our assurance of that, we can stay the course of our mission. We can stay on task of loving God by loving others. We can stay with that and not worry about all these other things. All right, well, let's read the last section of this chapter, verses 32 to 37. "However, no one knows the day or hour when these things will happen, not even the angels in heaven or the Son himself. Only the Father knows. And since you don't know when that time will come, be on guard. Stay alert. The coming of the Son of Man can be illustrated by the story of a man going on a long trip. When he left home, he gave each of his slaves instructions about the work they were to do, and he told the gatekeeper to watch for his return. You too must keep watch, for you don't know when the master of the household will return. In the evening, at midnight, before dawn, or at daybreak. Don't let him find you sleeping when he arrives without warning. I say to you what I say to everyone, which is a stunning portion of Scripture to me, because I suddenly feel like Jesus has looked up from the text and is looking directly at me. What I say to you, I say to everyone, watch for him. Okay. So, what does Jesus, and this is when, actually more appropriately, when does Jesus say all of this is going to happen in this text? No one knows, except me. Here's 20 reasons why Jesus is going to return in 2020. Since Jesus says that nobody knows when he's going to return, and he makes that very explicit, doesn't he? What should we not be doing?
Trying to figure it out.
It seems like it would make sense. And yet, we live in a world where it happens consistently. In balancing out his statements about the fig tree and being alert, he finishes off with a qualifier. And this, I believe, is our takeaway, that we can be assured. Whoops. We can be assured. Where am I? We can be assured that no one knows when the end is going to happen. That's, you know, not Bible scholars, not prophetic types, not famous authors, not pastors. Jesus says that even he, in his humanity, didn't know when this was going to occur, when he was there with them. Jesus tells the story of a guy who goes on a trip, and he leaves instructions for all of his staff to stay on task because they wouldn't know when the master was going to return. And it's important not to be sleeping or busy with something other than what they were told to do when the master returns. That's what Jesus is saying there. And that's what he's instructing when he was saying, keep watch. The point is, stay on task because we don't know when Jesus will return. And as clear as Jesus makes that, it hasn't stopped people from making predictions on the regular about when this is all going to end. I don't understand it, but I think that it's one of those things that, I think it's one of those things that just seems to trigger something us as human beings. It's one of those things that seem to keep us going. You know, when the whole Christian thing starts to feel too mundane, do you know what I'm talking about in that? Where, you know, I got to get up and not kick the dog and make sure I brush my teeth or whatever. And it doesn't feel that exciting. You know, I'm a Christian in this world. Yeah. You know, so what? I mean, how is that really making any kind of a difference? But boy, if somebody comes along with all the, you know, expectations, the predictions of when this is going to happen, oh man, it gets a little jump in the step, doesn't it? I mean, it's just like, woo, you know, this could be happening. Let's go. I got something to do. And I'm telling you, that's exactly, I believe, what Jesus is warning against in this. We shouldn't be wasting 1 ounce of energy on that sort of activity. Honestly, the moment I hear someone give a date for the return of Christ, I usually think, well, I can pretty well be sure it's not going to happen then. Except I'm not even comfortable making that prediction because, you know, who knows? Jesus is telling us this because he doesn't want us running around crying wolf over and over so that we all become desensitized to the power of this promise that he will return and set things right. He wants us to focus on being faithful servants of God's kingdom right here and right now with what's before us at this moment. And think about that. I mean, you know, this is what he means by keep watch. Faithful servants that were keeping watch weren't spending all their time watching over the wall to see if the master was coming down the road, to see if they could see signs of somebody moving off in the distance or whatever, just staring out over the wall the whole time. No, faithful servants were those who were doing what they were supposed to be doing when he was with them. They're the ones functioning as though he were still right there, and they believe that he's real and that he's in, you know, his activities were sanctioned and appropriate. So we need to live ready, but we don't want to get so caught up in end time speculation and sensationalism that we leave undone what God has called us to do in our everyday life. To be faithful, to commit our hearts and our lives to him, to live faithfully, to seek to live in such a way that the fruits of God's kingdom are evident in our lives and in the way that we interact with our fellow human being, to be a church that embodies the values of God's kingdom of love and grace and forgiveness right here on earth in its present state, in the troubles that we face, to be trusting in a real Savior in a real world, to not keep our attention off on the things that seem sensational, but to do those mundane but important things that make up the demonstration and witness of the kingdom in this world. Not being paralyzed by some obsession of what's going to happen next. The best way to prepare for Christ's coming is to be faithful with what we've been given to do today. It's all about how we're living right now. So honestly, this is the summary of this section. We can be assured that the world can and probably will get worse. And we're okay with that because we're also assured that Jesus will return and he will set all things right. So we live with anticipation of our final redemption. We live as though that's a reality for our lives right now. And that enables us to be faithful right here and right now with the love and the grace and the forgiveness and the truth that he's given us to live in. Right on? All right, very cool. As we're closing here real quick, I just want to mention that Cade Adams, where are you, man?